This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Ebola has been getting a lot of attention lately, and with good reason. Thousands have died in West Africa, and for the first time, Ebola has spread from person to person in the United States. Here to help us sort out the issue of Ebola is one of the leading epidemiologists in the world. Dr. Michael Osterholm is a professor and director for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. He also spent 25 years at the Minnesota Department of Health, including 15 years as the state epidemiologist. We talked with him a few weeks ago during a visit to UW-La Crosse. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Dr. Osterholm to talk about the history of Ebola.
Ebola virus actually gets its name from the Ebola River in the Congo, where it was first discovered in 1976 with the first outbreak. It's what we call a filovirus or a long-threaded virus. We believe that the natural reservoir for it actually are bats in the tropical rainforests of the equatorial belt of Africa. This particular virus that we are dealing with now, there are several strains of it. The one in particular is called Ebola Zaire, named after the former Congo, was then called Zaire. It stretches really across that area from eastern to western Africa. The illness that we see in humans with the virus being transmitted from bats to some other animal species, potentially bushmeat or even subhuman primates, other monkeys, that humans ultimately eat, that's how we typically come in contact with it. And it's an illness that really is relatively new to humans in a sense. And what I mean by that is that the first outbreak was documented in 1976 in a very, very difficult-to-reach area of the rainforest of Africa, in an area where the human population has historically for centuries been numbered in the hundreds, not in the thousands. And in this outbreak, the patients presented with fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and then upwards of 70% of them went on and died as a result of a shock-like condition. We now know today that that probably is about what you'd expect to see with untreated Ebola. We think we can do better today with treatments that are supportive care. We don't have specific drugs yet that are licensed and approved to treat the Ebola virus, but if you try to treat the shock in supportive care, you can likely reduce that, as we've seen with this outbreak. When I say it really hasn't infected humans much, since 1976, we've had a total of 24 outbreaks or case encounters, meaning single cases or laboratory accidents. 19 of these have really been what we call community-wide outbreaks in Africa. And of those 19 outbreaks, there have been about 2,400 cases, which isn't very many when you think about a virus in humans. More specifically, only in one outbreak did we get as many as we call generations, five generations. Generations are where one person transmits to another as one generation. They then transmit to a second person, two generations. So the way I look at this is that the virus really has hardly pinged the human species before now. And so what we're seeing in Western Africa is absolutely unprecedented in terms of the transmission of the virus to humans, and that's what makes it so challenging.
It's more than just the first time a human-to-human transmission has happened in our country. What's happening in West Africa is truly historic.
And it is for several reasons. First of all, in previous outbreaks, again, most of them occurring in the rural, very dense jungle areas of Africa where human contact is at best sporadic, so that there's almost a natural limiting factor there for human-to-human transmission. The virus is transmitted through direct contact, meaning that people actually have contact with vomit or diarrhea, blood, other body fluids as such with an infected individual. We also believe that the longer you're ill, meaning that from the time you first become infected till the time you show signs and symptoms, it will average 8 to 10 days. But then you may be alive for 8 to 10 days after that or start to recover. And the longer you're sick with the virus, the more likelihood you are of transmitting more virus in the body fluids. But then once it's transmitted to individuals through that contact, then it just keeps going through these cycles. And as I said before, we've only seen five cycles of it in previous outbreaks. What's different here is clearly the virus is in a location that's very unlike previous outbreaks in Africa. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post in July in which I talked about the virus hadn't changed, but Africa had changed, meaning that these urban areas didn't exist before. And now this virus showed up in the three capitals of Sierra Leone, Guinea and Liberia, where we had large slum areas of many thousands of people, so that just the contact was likely to occur. We're still not sure that today it's just because of the contact, meaning that it could be. But there are also some other signs that maybe this virus is a little bit different than the other Ebola viruses we've seen, and therefore it could be there's some enhanced transmission possibilities.
Does this Ebola outbreak compare to any other infectious disease outbreak we've seen around the world?
Well, I can't say that we've seen anything quite like this in this kind of close contact outbreak. You know, we've got a situation right now where we have this Mideastern respiratory syndrome, a SARS-like virus situation on the Arabian Peninsula, which we're concerned about. You know, we have influenza in outbreaks in China from birds transmitted to humans with the potential for a worldwide pandemic. You know, HIV obviously appearing in 1980-81, which also marked a beginning of a large pandemic or worldwide outbreak. That's what a pandemic is. This one is very unusual in the sense that it's this kind of close contact, and people living in close contact are naturally going to infect others. When you think of a household, if you use that term, particularly in the slum areas of these large cities where you have many people packed in very unsanitary, tight conditions, obviously the potential to transmit with body fluid situations is real. The other thing is we love our family. We love those around us. We want to be there for them. We want to touch them. We want to help clean up after they've had a vomiting episode or diarrheal episode. Now that can all be a very deadly kind of a situation. What really concerns us right now, and by the time this show airs, we're going to know more about this, is the fact that the likelihood of this moving eastward into Central Africa is really very real. I wrote a piece in Politico a couple of weeks ago in which I detailed the worker migration patterns of Africa, which are well known, just as they are in this country. And what you see, actually, is that many boys and young men come home to these three countries in the middle of what would be our summer, July, and they harvest the crops right up through late September and early October before the rainy season starts, and then they head back east again. They go back to the gold mines, the cocoa plantations, the illegal charcoal operations, and that may take them as far east as Nigeria and even in some cases as far east as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We're very concerned that this virus is going to start to move right now, and if that does, that's really very troubling because the large cities of the equatorial African area like Lagos, Kinshasa, Nairobi, all have slums that by any one of them are much larger than all the three slums of the three capital cities of the affected countries have today. So the potential for many more millions of people to be involved in this is very real.
Have you been involved in this at all, providing advice to anybody?
Yes, actually, our group at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota has been very involved with this. We really helped spearhead information about how to protect healthcare workers, which this past week we were very glad to see that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention changed those recommendations. We had been recommending these changes for some weeks and well before the Dallas situation occurred. We are also working on vaccine issues and how to expedite finding and actually manufacturing and then distributing an effective Ebola vaccine. We've been doing a lot with trying to help policymakers come to understand why this is such a significant issue. We've done briefings in Washington with some frequency to public health, but also intelligence experts, et cetera, why this is so important. Imagine if this virus continues to move through central into eastern Africa, the potential there for failed states to become very, very dysfunctional and lead to the opportunity for terrorists to even expand their operations, their training bases, without any kind of opposition would be very real at this move. So there's a tremendous concern about the economic, political viability of Africa right now with Ebola.
How would you describe the reaction in this country?
Well, you know, the reaction in this country is not unexpected. you know, for all those of us who have been through diseases like AIDS and West Nile virus and a lot of things like this, is first of all, there's almost a total lack of interest. Nobody has real concern. When I wrote my piece, my first piece in July in the Washington Post, it was really an attempt to get people to wake up and pay attention that this is really a very important situation. I wrote a subsequent piece in the New York Times in September and Politico also in September, and was just trying to help people understand what was going on and why we had to respond in a very different way. Well, then along comes the case that is now infamous in this country, the Mr. Duncan, who was seen in Dallas, Texas, and what was clearly a series of unfortunate mistakes by the healthcare system, both in terms of his recognition of his illness, his treatment, and then in addition the protection that was provided to healthcare workers, how the public health agencies responded to the quarantine or of his contacts and so forth. It was really a problem. But then here we sit now several weeks out from that event, and I worry that our country is still not real well prepared for handling a case somewhere in this country, and I think we will have more cases that will come in. The epidemic in West Africa is only going to get bigger and bigger. We're going to see more cases happening there. Everything that we've worried about in terms of number of new cases is continuing to happen. Our global response has been very, very slow, really terribly unfortunate. So the cases numbers have really continued to climb.
Is this not surprising because we don't take infectious disease in this country very seriously? I mean, we're coming up on influenza season or the start of it. The enterovirus, from what I understand, is a very serious concern in this country.
Yeah. You know, it's a situation where what scares us versus what worries us versus what hurts us versus what kills us sometimes can all be very different. You know, we have to acknowledge in West Africa so far this year, more people have died from HIV/AIDS, malaria, diarrheal diseases, in childbirth, TB, and not Ebola. But none of those threaten the financial or political stability of West Africa. And so we have to be cognizant there are some diseases that just by the very fear and panic they create that we do have to understand that we have to be able to respond to those in a bit different way. I think in this country, it's a situation where it's over there. It's not here. You know, we have had one case in an incoming person as of this date. We've had two healthcare workers. Tragic cases, unfortunately, we don't want any more. But when you think about what's happening in Africa, we expect 10,000 new cases just in these three little countries this month alone, and the number is growing quickly. That gives you some context, some perspective. And again, I come back to the fact that the way the world is going to respond to this will really determine Africa's long-term political and financial stability. I would add one last piece to this is that our country really has led the way. It has been by far the most vocal about the need to respond. It has challenged the rest of the world to respond in a really thoughtful and major way. The problem is we're operating on program of bureaucracy time, and the virus is operating in virus time. What we see from this administration is clearly a commitment to deal with this. But 6 weeks ago, the President of the United States said we'd have 3,000 troops here. Until last week, we only had 150 to 200 troops there. We still haven't built any of those 1,700 beds that were promised and staffed them with medical people, even though it's weeks and weeks later. People have donated money to respond. And from a government perspective, very little has been done yet. So in that sense, it's coming. But the problem with it is the analogy would be like if every time you had a fire here in La Crosse, you had to call the 911 operator in Minneapolis to send the fire trucks down. By the time they got here, you know, half the city could be ablaze. And we have just been so slow to respond, even though we want to. And we've got to change that. And that's why actually I'm very hopeful and very positive about the new Ebola czar that's been appointed. This is a guy who is not a medical expert. We don't want a medical expert. We've got plenty of them. We need somebody that can get things done. We need somebody that can cut through the red tape. We need a Manhattan Project-like approach.
Do you have faith in the Center for Disease Control?
I do. I have faith in the organization and in its leaders. I think that there were some mistakes made on messaging, first of all, in terms of just how certain we were about what we knew was going on. I actually gave a talk at Johns Hopkins University several weeks ago urging we not do that, that we just tell the truth and say what we know and what we don't know, and with what we don't know, what we're going to do to find out. I think the second piece of it also is, though, that there was a great overestimation of how well the American healthcare system was prepared for a case of Ebola. I can say with absolute certainty that had that case of Mr. Duncan's occurred in many other cities around the United States, the response wouldn't have been any better than it was in Dallas. And we're working hard at this time to improve that response. You know, not every one of the 5,000 hospitals in this country needs to be able to treat an Ebola patient. They just shouldn't, any more than we'd expect all 5,000 hospitals to treat a severely burned patient or somebody with a major cardiac problem. You want to go to the places that are prepared to do that. But what also is really important is you want to take them to a place where the people have really practiced and trained on how to prevent this infection, where they know how to use this equipment we call PPE, personal protective equipment, how to use it, and so you don't have a problem with that. So I think that the message right now to America is every healthcare worker in this country has to be prepared to recognize a potential case of Ebola. We don't know when it's going to come in, where it's going to come in. It could come to an emergency room, to a doctor's office, to an urgent care. We don't know. But once you suspect that case as a healthcare worker, then we need a system where that person can be readily isolated so that they don't transmit the virus to anyone else, and they can be taken to a facility where they will get high level of treatment, and we can protect the healthcare workers who work there.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking with one of the leading epidemiologists in the world about issues related to the most recent outbreak of Ebola. Dr. Michael Osterholm is the former epidemiologist for the state of Minnesota and is currently a professor and the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. We're recording this interview in late October during a lecture visit by Dr. Osterholm to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. We've seen travel restrictions to the United States as a result of this. We've seen new screening procedures at airports. Are those reasonable responses to this? And should they have been done sooner?
Well, first of all, let me just say that as a public health person, my first and foremost goal is to prevent transmission of the virus wherever it may be. So I've never been afraid of taking a stand that says this is a good thing or it's not a good thing, based on what was politically correct or what was seen as the socially acceptable thing to do. What are the data that support that it makes a difference? Now, when you talk about a travel ban or screening, it means many different things to many different people. So let's just talk about what we're doing in the United States and what's being done in West Africa now, as of today. And that is that, first of all, someone who becomes infected with the Ebola virus, meaning I had contact today with someone's body fluids and I get infected today, the clock starts ticking. I will not necessarily show symptoms for 10, 11 days and maybe as long as 19, 20 days, then before I get ill. During that time period, I am not infectious. I do not transmit the virus to others. If you have contact with me, it's not a problem. It's only when I become clinically ill that I actually have those the risk of transmitting the virus. So what's being done today is to look for sick people wanting to leave Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea, or any other country that may ultimately have the virus show up, and to make sure that I didn't have a known contact. That's the first level of screening. So that basically if I have symptoms of illness that might be compatible with Ebola, you know, you shouldn't get on a plane. But then, of course, with this incubation period, what if I was exposed yesterday? I'm not going to get sick for 9 or 10 more days, much as we saw with Mr. Duncan in Dallas. And then I come to another country. We have to be prepared to quickly identify that person, isolate them, or meaning that we don't let them infect anyone else because we contain their body fluids. Every one of those cases should end in basically no additional cases. In Dallas, think about this. Mr. Duncan's contacts in the community, none of them became infected. And now we're over that period of time when we'd worry about that happening. It was only the two healthcare workers who were exposed in the provision of healthcare. And that's where we need to make sure that that doesn't happen. So we can effectively reduce the potential for transmission to countries like ours where if we just identify who's coming in from West Africa and having no symptoms or whatever, you know, basically say, okay, come on in, and then follow them. Now, some will say, but why even worry about that? Well, we have a desperate need to move goods and people in and out of Africa right now for the very purposes of the response. Imagine if in La Crosse we had a major crisis here, but the one thing we said is nobody can get into La Crosse, and therefore really nobody can get out. And so that in that sense, we're not doing this just because we're trying to be nice people or because we think that this is the right thing to do. There are data from previous outbreak situations like this where travel bans, screening of individuals beyond what's being done was just not effective. People got out anyway. If you suppress people from leaving those countries, they'll get out, and we'll still have to deal with it. So I think that the current approach really is a very reasonable and thoughtful one, where our goal is to have no additional transmissions outside of the three affected countries, but at the same time allow people in and out. Let me just add one last piece. One of the problems we have today is that we desperately need more healthcare workers to be in West Africa, to come and volunteer. That is not an insignificant commitment. I mean, you literally are putting your life on the line to do that because the conditions there are much, much more dire in terms of treatment and conditions, et cetera. So, you know, you can still do a lot to protect yourself and minimize your risk, but you're still nonetheless putting yourself in harm's way. The one thing we hear over and over again from healthcare workers that are willing to go and said, I just have one request. If I get sick, bring me home. Now imagine, you know, us bringing people home from Africa with Ebola virus to the United States. We've already heard complaints about the healthcare workers who were allowed into the United States because of that, noting that, of course, none of those healthcare workers transmitted to anyone, and they're now officially not infected. So we have to also be mindful of that. And I actually had people who challenged whether they should come in. Well, I can tell you, if we don't allow these people in when they're infected and we know they're infected, we're going to see a great reduction in the number of people that actually are willing to go and work there. And if that happens, that's to shoot ourselves in the foot because we need to stop that epidemic there. I consider that the infectious disease forest fire in West Africa. And those sparks are going to keep flying out around the world until we put that forest fire out. So we need healthcare workers. So I'm willing to bring any healthcare worker who's infected home to be treated here.
The international medical community is doing a good job, you think, in West Africa?
Well, what's happened is what we call NGOs, non-governmental organizations like Doctors Without Borders and so forth, have done a great job. In fact, Doctors Without Borders tried to warn us about this in March, that this was a very different kind of Ebola outbreak than they had seen in the past. They understand this like no other group. Their care and their commitment to dealing with this in West Africa has been nothing short of almost miraculous. As some of the listeners may know, they won the Nobel Prize for Peace a few years ago for their work. And if there's any organization that deserves a second Nobel Prize, it's Doctors Without Borders. They have just been an incredible asset to this whole area. And frankly, one of the troubling pieces about all this is that we shouldn't have to count on a non-governmental organization like Doctors Without Borders to be the foundation of a response in these areas. The governments of the world should step up, and we need much more out of the government. So from the private side, I'd say the NGOs have done an amazing job. From the government side, we've been very slow to respond, and that's been a big problem.
What do we need from the government?
Well, right now we need treatment beds. We need healthcare workers. We need logistical support. It's very difficult to get items moved in and out and around these countries. We're now entering the rainy season, which makes it even more complicated. For those who haven't been to West Africa or the equatorial parts of the world during the rainy season, imagine what it's like in La Crosse with a 25 to 30-inch blizzard. Okay? Now you're trying to make things work. Well, go to West Africa during the rainy season and try to make things work. It's very similar. So, for example, the 3,000 original military assets that were promised, and then in addition, another 1,000 soldiers were promised, those people are really all about logistical support, supply chains, you know, making things move, getting things around, not treating patients, not doing the kind of patient care that some people thought. And that's what they're really good at. They're really good at that. We need those assets over there now.
So how do we contain this in Africa?
There's really two approaches. They're complementary. One is a Band-Aid. The other one is actually the treatment. The Band-Aid is how we've controlled them in the past. You know, we basically have been able as a public health community to, in the smaller outbreaks, identify cases quickly, isolate them so they don't transmit to anyone else, including healthcare workers, and then follow up on all the contacts of that case. So you identify everybody that was in contact with that case over the previous number of days that they were ill. And then as soon as they might start to show signs and symptoms, you isolate them. And pretty soon you basically choke off the virus. It doesn't transmit anymore, and that's how these were all stopped in the past. Well, that's kind of like swimming basically across a pond here somewhere around La Crosse where there's no current. Now imagine you're swimming upstream up the Mississippi. And you're a pretty good swimmer, but you're just below the dam. And, you know, it turns out after the first hour, you're actually a mile farther down than you started, let alone upstream, okay, because you're up against a heavy current. That's kind of what's happening here. We have had so many cases that this isolation and quarantine of people just isn't working. We don't have the resources to do it and the treatment beds to isolate people out of the community. So what we can do is try to increase that and try to slow this thing down, you know, put a somewhat of a break on it. But the real key is going to be vaccine. Vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. We need one badly. We don't have a vaccine for this yet. There are several in the research phase, of which they look quite good. We need to expedite that, and we need to do it quickly. And this is ultimately going to be the only way that we're going to see this outbreak come to an end is with this vaccine. I feel quite certain of that.
So now this Ebola outbreak is on the minds of more Americans than it was two or three months ago, I guess. When it goes away, what needs to happen around the world or in this country?
The world is a very different place today. Think about this. With 7.6 billion people on the face of the earth today, one out of every eight people who's ever lived is on the face of the earth right now. Many of them are living in the megacities of the developing world, which if Dickens could write about poverty, squalor, and dire straits, he would actually be surprised how bad it is today in these settings. And they're perfect laboratories, basically, for spreading or even creating human infectious agents. On top of that, we travel around the world today. We basically oceans and mountains and canyons no longer are barriers for the movement of infectious agents. Not long ago, I was in Hyderabad, India. Early one morning, I gave a lecture at the University of Minnesota that night. You know, that's an example of just how we move around the world. Last year, 1.1 billion people crossed an international border, one out of every seven people on the face of the earth. And so the other thing is we move agents around the world quickly. On top of that, in order to feed the world, we actually now have concentrated agricultural production. So the fact that in China they're growing every month 780 million new chickens just in the areas outside of Shanghai just to provide Shanghai with chicken, 780 million birds. A bird today, a chicken from the time it's hatched till it's a chicken breast on your plate is about 30 to 33 days. Those are all ideal ways to grow microbes again in this kind of huge containment area like that of animals. And then you put that all together and you realize that microbes in of themselves have always had the advantage of, it's kind of like gravity and, you know, throwing something, you know, in the end, who's going to win? It's going to be gravity. When you think about a microbe, reproduces on an average about every 20 minutes. And they're kind of sloppy for many of them in terms of how they reproduce themselves. They don't always get it right, the exact genetic material. A lot of those mutations actually are disadvantaged to the microbe, and they die, or they surely don't survive as well. Others, however, turn out by chance occurrence, this thing called evolution, to actually make them more superior. They can withstand things that they couldn't before or do things they couldn't do before. Now, think about this. You and I go through a generation maybe every 20 years. They go through one every 20 minutes. And so microbial evolution has always trumped human evolution. And as one of the former great late Nobel Prize winners, Josh Lederberg, once said, the microbes were here before us, they're here while we're here, and they're going to be here after we're gone. And so when you add that all together, it should make people realize that we do have to be very aware of the infectious disease risks of the world. And while we surely have done a great deal to conquer them over the last century, from a time when they were the leading cause of death in even the developed world to a time now, these new threats are real. I mentioned to you earlier about Middle Eastern Respiratory Center, MERS. This is a SARS-like virus that's in the Middle East. We're seeing a big flare-up of that today as I speak. We know that we have major influenza virus activity in China right now that is some of the bird flu viruses where they're in birds occasionally infecting humans. Any one of those could go tomorrow and become a worldwide pandemic influenza virus of very, very serious nature. So because of all these combinations of things, because of this global one-world infectious disease problem, we have to be mindful of this in responding in ways that we didn't in the past.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He's also been advising the medical community and federal government about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis had a chance to interview him when he spoke at UW-La Crosse in late October. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, the City of La Crosse and BNSF Railway reach an agreement on conditions that will allow the railroad to increase train traffic through the city. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. BNSF Railway and the City of La Crosse reached an agreement last week on conditions that will allow the railroad to add a second set of tracks through the city. Here to talk about the deal are La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot and Maureen Friedland. She represents Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, a group that opposes the expansion. Mayor Cabot talks about some of the details of the agreement.
We really try to focus on a few areas, primarily dealing with safety and emergency preparedness and response. Some of the other issues that we could not get agreement on, you know, we're going to continue to pursue. And we were looking to try to, as much as possible, mitigate any negative financial impacts to the city and as well as work on mitigation of the La Crosse River Marsh. So in essence, the agreement provides that BNSF will address the utility crossings. There's, again, 10 to 11 utilities that are impacted, so BNSF is going to take care of that. They're going to address the at-grade crossings as a part of the Forest Hills Municipal Golf Course. There's two at-grade crossings. Those will be closed. The railroad is going to construct an underpass, which will allow for the safe travel of pedestrians and golf carts. And then we are also looking, as a part of our side of it, is to extend that trail up so that we can have a safe connection up to the trailhead for Hicks and Forest, to the parking area up there. And along with that, then the railroad is going to provide a incentive payment of $830,000 for the city to be able to use and to address, again, the golf course and relocation on some of those things so that we can, in essence, get everything out of the railroad right-of-way and get it all onto the east side of the tracks. The railroad is going to provide a foam car and foam material, so that is a firefighting piece of equipment, along with two trailers to deal with spills that are in water. So there's a boom trailer that the railroad is also providing to help us to deal with issues in water if there's a spill or a fire. And then the railroad is also providing a training for 54 firefighters over the course of 3 years to deal with both the foam firefighting and the other pieces of trying to address emergency situations by railroad.
So in the end, how do you feel about this agreement?
You don't get everything that you want. I mean, we did really try to push hard on things like rail speeds, trying to reduce the overall speed of traffic, trying to address the blocked crossings.
And BNSF has said that So they want to keep it at 45 miles per hour going through some of the areas there, and they're not looking at changing it at this point.
Not at this point, no. And just as a reminder, the train speeds, the the makeup of the cars, the length of cars, how long they are at crossings and all that is all regulated, and it's in the responsibility of the Federal Railroad Administration. There have been a couple of communities that have been able to get voluntary agreements on train speeds, which is what we really tried to push, but ultimately we didn't get that in the agreement. And our goal was to try to mitigate as much of the negative impacts and to try to address those, especially the safety and emergency response as best we could.
And Maureen Friedland, in the end, how do you feel about the agreement?
We knew it was going to be a tough one, and with the lack of local ability to control the railroads, we were going to only be able to get so far. It's sad that the corporation's efficiency is really the first thing that the corporation is worried about, and in response, the DOTs that were ruled unsafe 20 years ago...
The tank cars you're talking about?
Yes. The tank cars are still going to be on the route. We're pleased that many of the city's expenses can be covered, hopefully for a break even. And we appreciate the work of the city council members and the mayor. But we're disappointed because we have continuing concerns. Accidents are still increasing with the exponential growth of oil that's being extracted from the Bakkens. We have frac sand going in one direction, crude oil for export, it going in the other, a lot of it for export. And we have a fifth of the population of La Crosse County living within a half a mile on either side of the tracks. If there is an accident, and there will be an accident somewhere, I hope it's not in our area, then our area is going to be at risk. A river disaster would affect the river's commerce, tourism, and even with this agreement, local emergency response can only react. There's nothing in there for the marsh, such as booms. The cost of sending the firefighters to training is going to be another cost that the city is going to have. And even with the incentives to help offset the cost, we feel like the city was basically held hostage. It felt a need to act quickly, and that we need to continue moving towards lower speed limits. We thought that 30 miles per hour would have been a reasonable amount of speed. We want the railroad and we want the city to continue to do everything in its power to eliminate unsafe tankers passing through our areas. So we plan to continue. There is a marsh aspect of this. There are permits that still need to be obtained from the Army Corps of Engineers and from the DNR, and we'll be involved in that stage. Even after that, we continue to want to be involved on a regional level and on a federal level with the assistance of the city as well.
Mayor, I'm curious, as Maureen said, she felt like the city was held hostage. Do you feel like it was sort of inevitable that the second track was going to be coming in?
I guess the short answer is yes. It did feel, again, the railroad through federal preemption and the federal laws that have been passed over the many decades, in essence, greatly limits local ability to have much regulatory oversight on rail traffic. I mean, you have interstate commerce and you have federal preemption and a whole bunch of laws that limit what cities can and can't do. I think it was pointed out in one of the testimony during the public hearing that way back in 1880-something, the city of La Crosse had enacted some local laws to deal with, train speeds through the city and how that has obviously changed in the 100-plus years. And we are very sensitive to our La Crosse River Marsh, and that was one other piece of the agreement that I didn't touch on earlier, and that is the notion that we are going to continue to work really hard to make sure that the mitigation piece stays here in La Crosse, because that's basically the holdup as to why BNSF doesn't have their permits from the DNR and the Army Corps, because there's not a mechanism currently in place to deal with the mitigation the way that the railroad would like. regardless of whether it's a payment in lieu of or an actual mitigation project, we are going to fight to make sure that that gets done in our area.
BNSF will be acquiring about 7 acres of the marsh. And with the mitigation law that exists within Wisconsin, the DNR essentially has to either create or provide some sort of financial incentive to almost recreate 7 acres of wetlands somewhere within Wisconsin. And I understand the city is trying to push for that to occur somewhere near the marsh. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's three ways through the Army Corps and through the DNR process to mitigate wetlands. There's, you know, you can buy credits that there's a wetland bank. Unfortunately, there's not any of those credits available right now. There's the what's called a permittee responsible project where, again, BNSF would actually go and create, you know, new wetlands somewhere. And then there's this payment in lieu of, which the state of Wisconsin does not have that program. So you're looking at a whole set of rules that have to get created and then adopted by the Army Corps from the state. And I believe that's, you know, at least in our conversations, that's what the railroad wants to do, is be able to pay a payment in lieu of. And again, our stance is that money should, or those resources should, stay here. We have identified projects in our La Crosse River marsh that will improve flood capacity and storage and water flow. So we're ready to go with those resources. Right now, we're just to the point of trying to convince the state and the Army Corps that this is the right way to go.
We're also very complimentary of the city for wanting to have a local plan and for working with the Burlington Northern on that. Members of our group participated in helping to put that together. But there are more issues about the marsh that we're concerned about. All of the information has not been submitted yet about how the project will take place, and we still want some inquiries to be made about flood levels and about the impact, the cumulative impact on the marsh. So there are some issues besides just how the mitigation will take place that we're concerned about.
Are there other neighborhood issues that you're thinking about when it comes to adding this double track? Obviously, we heard a lot from people living in those areas that there are concerns about safety, Maureen, as you talked about before, also mm-hmm. issues with noise and the vibrations. So what now can the city do, or what now can BNSF do to sort of alleviate some of those concerns since this track is coming in?
We still have concerns that there will be congestion. And while we hope that the congestion will be relieved, we're still not completely sure what the impact of Grand Crossing is and whether this is going to really take care of the issue. And speaking of Grand Crossing, we need to mention Canadian Pacific. We hope that the city will inquire also as to issues that are involved with Canadian Pacific, such as speed. And now that we have this agreement in place, that the city has this agreement in place, that they'll go on to see what the impacts on Canadian Pacific are on other neighborhoods. We wanted, as I said before, to have slower speeds and common sense controls for the crossings, for both of the rails to have the new quiet technology. And we aren't sure what the amount of relief can be obtained for neighborhoods right now. We know there's the $830,000 that Burlington Northern will pay for the city to move along quickly, and we haven't had any statements, to the best of my knowledge, whether any of that money can be used for neighborhood improvements or even for some basic vibration studies, so that we have the basis going forward, people have the basis going forward for protecting their homes. We'd like to see either the city or Burlington Northern to do some vibration studies and pollution studies. And these are for the whole city. This is not just for that area. There's going to be an economic impact on the entire city. In our view, this isn't just about making the golf course better. It's about creating recreational opportunities and preserving our trails. we are pleased that the trails will be looked at and their integrity will be looked at. And that's for the entire city. Also, let me just go back for a second about the marsh. We're also concerned about the marsh as a recreational opportunity, too. And that's part of the cumulative impact that is going to be looked at there. So we continue to be concerned about neighborhoods and with the impact for the entire city. We also want to go on and bridge with other communities and work to create awareness on the federal level about train safety and about how we really need to be able to have more local controls. There's a lot of points that the mayor and I agree on as far as lower speeds, and we need to continue to work together on those aspects.
So, Mayor, is there any sense that $830,000 or so, could that go towards some of the neighborhood improvement issues that Maureen touched upon, and when does that get decided?
Well, that's a decision to be made by the city council as it really decides on where to utilize those resources. You know, primarily we have discussed the costs involved and the safety involved with getting the golf course operations onto the, you know, all onto the east side of the tracks, whether or not there could be portions of those funds used for some of those neighborhood mitigations or you know, developing baseline information on vibrations or noise. You know, that's entirely reasonable. We can we'll have to talk about that with the council, and they'll have to make that decision. I do think the larger issue that just continues to be out there, I guess, is the overall safety. We have utilized our voice from the city's standpoint with our federal legislators to move forward as quickly as possible on the rulemaking to deal with the tank car standards, to have much higher and a much more safe tank car that ships this material, to get rid of the DOT 111s, you know, more quickly than the 2 years that they're talking about, to stabilize oil before it's shipped, because that's a relatively, from what I understand, a relatively simple thing to do, which would greatly reduce the volatility of that being shipped. And apparently we do that now when we ship the oil overseas, when it's loaded onto ships, but we don't do that in our own country. So those are the kinds of things that we have been pushing and will continue to push, again, because those are federal rules and federal standards. And, you know, I've encouraged everybody that's contacted my office through this whole process. I mean, again, we're trying to do the best we can locally with those impacts, but ultimately we need to work with our federal legislators to, you know, have very stringent standards on how this material is being shipped, because, I mean, the reality is it's here to stay. It's going to be here for the foreseeable future, and it will be increasing, I think, as they just continue with the the demand for oil. So it's one of those very difficult issues that we find ourselves again kind of right front and center, and we're going to do everything we can with our citizens as well as our federal folks to try to make sure it's as safe as possible.
Right, that's excellent, and we want that to continue. We know that a lot of these issues are on the federal level. There's also perhaps some state possibilities. The state of Minnesota has passed legislation that would create funds of money that could be used for local emergency protectors. Would like to see that. Minnesota has also created funds that would raise money for more inspections. So would like to see the legislature take those issues up. This is not a political issue. This is something that affects all of us. And we need to continue working with our federal legislators, and our area legislators have been very involved in this, to require the railroads to fund equipment and supplies and training on an ongoing basis.
Maureen Friedland is with Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, or CARS, which has opposed expanding rail service in the La Crosse area. She was joined by La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot. They've been talking about an agreement reached last week between the City of La Crosse and BNSF Railway that will allow an expansion of train tracks in the city. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum.
BNSF has said all along it wants to add the second track to eliminate a traffic bottleneck that forms in La Crosse. Spokeswoman Amy McBeth says it'll ultimately improve service for their customers who ship goods via rail.
The project is going to be put in place for the traffic that's on our route today. So when we talk about in areas where we can improve our efficiency, improve our movements of the trains that we have on our network, this is an area that we've identified, and so that's why we're proceeding with this project. Independent projections show that as the population grows in this country, rail traffic is likely to increase. It's market-driven, so what our customers ship is what we're going to ship on our railroad, and we want to be able to do that effectively and efficiently. But again, this project is put in place to be able to deal with the traffic that we're seeing there now, and we're pleased that we've been able to work out an agreement with the city that addresses some of the concerns that we've heard from them.
Amy McBeth is a spokeswoman for BNSF Railway. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. There, you'll also find a link to the BNSF agreement and documentation provided by the CARS Group. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.